Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. President's Day has just passed, and a show on the presidents, Capitol Hill movers and shakers, news-making public servants, spies and whistleblowers seemed a capital idea. Washington is never short of compelling stories. Whether it's a new perspective on the Founding Fathers, a memoir from a politician on the scene as history was being written, or a discovery of a dirty-dealing politico. And this week, for a real Inside the Beltway experience, we'll speak to the curator of the Law Library at the Library of Congress. We'll find out why the Magna Carta, a document from 1215, is still so incredibly relevant. Let's turn now to page one of the book report. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Edward Larson's new bestseller, The Return of George Washington, 1783 to 1789, covers a crucially important yet frequently overlooked chapter of the general's life. How Washington saved the country by coming out of retirement to head the Constitutional Convention and serve as our first president. After leading the Continental Army to victory, Washington shocked the world. In December 1783, Washington, the most powerful man in the country, stepped down as commander-in-chief and returned to private life at Mount Vernon. As Washington contentedly grew his estate, the fledgling American experiment floundered. Under the Articles of Confederation, the weak central government was unable to raise revenue to pay its debt or reach a consensus on national policy. The states bickered and grew apart. When a constitutional convention was established to address these problems, its chances of success were slim. Jefferson, Madison, and the other founding fathers realized only one man could unite the fractious states. Reluctant but duty-bound, Washington rode to Philadelphia in the summer of 1787 to preside over the convention and accept the presidency. This fascinating history is narrated by Mark Bramall.
The American people had called him to the presidency, and he was preparing to leave his beloved Mount Vernon plantation for the seat of government in New York on April 16, 1789. Due to private preservation efforts and public land use restrictions, this vista over the Potomac, the one that Washington most loved and built his piazza to frame, survives virtually unchanged in the midst of Northern Virginia's urban sprawl. As an inaugural fellow at the Fred W. Smith National Library for the Study of George Washington, with a residency on the grounds of Mount Vernon, I was able to enjoy this and other scenes on Washington's plantation many times over the course of a year. The view from the piazza became my favorite, too, especially at sunrise in the spring, when flowering trees and soft green leaves give off a warm glow in the early morning light. It was obvious why Washington was reluctant to leave Mount Vernon for public service in a job that he neither sought nor wanted. The words that Washington sent 6 months earlier to fellow Virginian James Madison, urging him to serve in the new federal government, applied equally to himself, however. Supporters of the new Constitution and the union it created, he had implored Madison, forgetting personal considerations, must combine their collective efforts through service in the new government to avert the great national calamities that impended without it. By 1787, 4 years since the United States secured its independence, Washington had come to believe that the country faced as grave a threat from internal forces of disunion in the mid-1780s as it had from external ones of tyranny in the mid-1770s, when he accepted leadership of the Patriot Army at the outset of the Revolutionary War. Now his country again called on his service, this time as the elected leader of the world's first extended republic. Countless books tell the story of Washington as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army during the American Revolution, and nearly as many relate the history of his role as the first president of the United States. Indeed, books about Washington could fill a library. They fill a bookcase in mine. Few of them focus on the 6 years between his wartime and presidential service, which is the subject of this one. Even the finest full biographies of Washington, from Douglas Southall Freeman's six-volume classic of the late 1940s and early 1950s, through James Thomas Flexner's masterful four-volume series of the late 1960s and early 1970s, to Ron Chernow's superb 2010 Washington, A Life, all Pulitzer Prize winners, devote the interlude between his military tenure and presidential terms mostly to presenting his life as a Virginia planter. Moreover, when biographers reached the Constitutional Convention over which Washington presided, they typically present him as a stiff, silent figure who mainly contributed his prestige and dignity to the proceedings. The standard narrative then has him retiring to Mount Vernon through the ratification debates and first federal election until called to the presidency.
That was The Return of George Washington by Edward Larson. As I've shared in the past, I was fortunate enough to work at the Library of Congress when I was in graduate school. Today, we're going to be speaking with Nathan Dorn, currently the curator of rare books at the Law Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., a position he has held since 2011. He holds a bachelor's degree in religion from the University of Chicago, a master's degree in Jewish studies from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and a master's degree in library and information science from Catholic University. Before coming to the Library of Congress, Nathan spent several years engaged in advanced graduate study of Rabbinic Judaism at the University of Chicago's Divinity School and in seminaries in Jerusalem. Nathan is also currently a JD candidate at Georgetown Law, and he has been the curator for the Library of Congress's Magna Carta exhibit. Welcome, Nathan, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Why is the Magna Carta, a document from the 13th century, still important today?
Well, that's a very, very good question. And I think if anybody takes the time to actually read the document and go through the language, what they'll discover is that it addresses concerns really from another world. So many things about institutions and customs that simply don't exist today, that haven't existed in centuries, and yet we're supposed to be looking at this document saying, well, this document is somehow the foundation of our constitutional tradition, and it's a puzzler. And it would have been a 13th century document that stayed in its 13th century and never traveled through posterity with some great reputation, except for a very specific chain of events that led to its evaluation and reevaluation over time, and eventually its use as a foundation for certain legal arguments that became very important in the course of time. Those legal arguments, after centuries, would become a springboard for people who would later claim constitutional rights that extended throughout history, and it's as a result of those processes and those historical events that we have come to think of Magna Carta as some great foundation of our constitutional rights.
For those of us with fuzzy historical memories, can you give us a brief overview of the document's history?
Sure. Magna Carta is a 13th century document. It was created in 1215 as a result of a compromise between King John of England and his tenants in chief, his major landholders. We call them the barons. There was a beginning of some kind of a civil war. The barons were revolting against King John as a result of a number of grievances. They felt that King John taxed them too much, that he cheated them out of money in the course of their payment for rights to their land. They felt that he was losing all of his foreign wars, which cost them tremendously, and they were unable to recoup the loss with land that they might have gained as a result of his victories. And many people were horrified by John's poor relationship with the Catholic Church, and as a result of the interactions he had with the Pope, many people in his kingdom were ready to look for new possibilities for the future of their kingdom.
Why did the Library of Congress decide to mount a Magna Carta exhibit at this time?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. We're looking ahead now at the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta. It was created in 1215, and here we are in the beginning of 1215. It was agreed upon in June of 1215. June 15th of 1215 is the date that everybody remembers. It probably underwent negotiations from June 15th to June 19th of that month. So celebrating the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta this year, in 2015. We figured this would be a great time to commemorate Magna Carta publicly, but then there's another anniversary that we were commemorating. Now, the Library of Congress is fortunate that we received Magna Carta on loan already for the first time in 1939. And we're commemorating the 75th anniversary of Magna Carta's first visit to the United States.
I see. You know, I had the opportunity to visit the exhibit, and I was really fascinated to learn about the Magna Carta's journey during World War II. Can you fill us in on that?
Sure. The story goes like this. Magna Carta came across the ocean to the United States in 1939 for an appearance at the World's Fair in New York City. It appeared there at the World's Fair for a number of months, and when the fair closed in October of 1939, the war was already on in Europe. And so conversations among the leadership turned to this idea that maybe it's not a great idea to move Magna Carta back across the ocean under uncertain conditions, and it might be nice to keep Magna Carta here in North America for the duration of the war. And so it was decided between Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the then Librarian of Congress Archibald MacLeish, and as well as the British Ambassador Lord Lothian and Winston Churchill, that Magna Carta would stay at the Library of Congress, and that's exactly what happened. There's a very elaborate handing off ceremony where the British ambassador arrived at the Library of Congress, and Archibald MacLeish was there, and speeches were delivered, and there was a large crowd, and they placed Magna Carta on display in the mezzanine of the Jefferson Building of the Library of Congress, the Thomas Jefferson Building, where it was on display next to the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. Those documents were still here at the Library of Congress at that time, and they would later be moved to the National Archives.
Well, that brings up another question. How does the Magna Carta displayed at the library differ from the one on display at the National Archives?
That's a very good question. You know, the Magna Carta as we imagine it is different from the Magna Carta that influenced history and influenced our constitutional tradition. Let me explain. The Magna Carta that influenced us in terms of law and historical development was a later reissue of Magna Carta, in fact. It was the Magna Carta of Henry III, a Magna Carta that was written in 1225. There were several Magna Cartas presented by English kings over the course of the 13th century. That 1225 Magna Carta became the text that would eventually be entered into English law in 1297. Now, we were saying that Magna Carta was created in 1215, and now I'm saying that it didn't enter into law until 1297, and that's right. It was never entered into the statute roll, the official record of English statutes, until that late date. And so the Magna Carta that people cite to in legal texts is always this 1225 Magna Carta. And that's the one that has had real influence in political debate and in legal writing for centuries. Now that's all well and good, but when we think about Magna Carta, of course what we think about is King John and the barons at Runnymede, and there's this conflict and they resolve it with this great document that would then stand for the ages as a symbol of the rule of law. And that's exactly why so the 1215 Magna Carta and the 1225 Magna Carta are so different. The 1225 Magna Carta really becomes the thing that influences history, whereas the 1215 Magna Carta is the thing that becomes symbolic and legendary. It's the Magna Carta of legend. It's the one we really remember.
We're speaking with Nathan Dorn, curator at the Library of Congress, on today's Book Report. When I visited the library this past month, I was fascinated by the Jefferson Library exhibit. Can you tell the listeners about that?
I'll be happy to. Thomas Jefferson was an incredible book collector. In the context of the 18th century, not very many people had large personal libraries. By the beginning of the 19th century, Jefferson had the largest personal library of anyone in America. It was 6,487 volumes, a really mammoth library, and it was a point of pride with Jefferson. Now, in 1814, the British burned the Capitol building during the course of the War of 1812, and as a result of that burning, the Library of Congress, which was then housed in the Capitol building, was destroyed. So afterwards, the thought began to circulate that we should reconstitute the Library of Congress by an act of acquisition, and acquiring Thomas Jefferson's library would take what might be one of the greatest libraries in the New World and make it a permanent heritage of the American people, a resource that the Congress could turn to have information on any imaginable topic. And that's precisely what Congress did. They purchased Jefferson's library for $23,000, almost $24,000 in 1815. And as a result of the acquisition, the Library of Congress has been in possession of Thomas Jefferson's personal library since that time. Now, Jefferson's library was never meant to be just some kind of heirloom. It was meant to be a real library for the use of the people. And so Jefferson's books were scattered throughout the library and were never held separately until very, very much later. It wasn't until just the beginning of the 21st century that the Library of Congress decided it was time to separate out and reconstitute Thomas Jefferson's collection. And there was a twist. On Christmas Eve of 1851, a fire destroyed nearly two-thirds of Jefferson's collection in the Capitol building at the Library of Congress in the Capitol. And as a result, we only had about a third of the a little better than a third of the books that Thomas Jefferson sold to the library when we began to reconstitute the collection. And so there was a project to rebuild and redevelop the collection according to a list of the items that were originally acquired. And so we replaced what we could from our own collection with sister copies of the editions that are listed in his list. And where we couldn't find those in our collection, we sent somebody out to acquire the rest of the items in Jefferson's collection, sister copies of those items, from vendors throughout the world. And so the result is what you can see now on display on permanent exhibit on the second floor of the Jefferson Building in the Library of Congress, and that's Thomas Jefferson's reconstituted library. It's a very beautiful glass installation, and it's something that if you have a chance, you should definitely come to see.
Nathan, it was a fascinating exhibit, and it's been wonderful speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Alrighty, bye.
Bye-bye.
In Founder's Son, celebrated historian Richard Brookhiser presents a compelling new biography of Abraham Lincoln that highlights his lifelong struggle to carry on the work of the Founding Fathers. Following Lincoln from his humble origins in Kentucky to the White House, Brookhiser shows us the president's many sides: laborer, lawyer, congressman, president, storyteller, depressive, poet, friend, and visionary. At every stage, Lincoln returned time and again to the founders. They were his political touchstones, the basis of his interest in politics, and the lodestars who guided him on the national scene. Norman Dietz narrates.
Madison, as Martineau put it, reposed cheerfully, gaily on his faith in the people's power of wise self-government. He had a concern of his own about the state of the nation, however, and that was slavery. Like Carroll, Madison was a planter and a slave owner. He had grown up with the institution, knew its evils from the inside, and discussed them frankly with Martineau. Slavery kept owners in a state of perpetual fear. It degraded slaves' minds, even when it did not brutalize them physically. He cited promiscuity and cruelty to animals as bad habits encouraged by lives of bondage. How could the country free itself of the evil? Ideally, Madison believed, slaves should be freed, though he had not freed his own. But where then could they go? Free states did not want them. Many had stringent laws to keep out black immigrants. Canada, he thought, was too cold for them. Maybe they could be sent back to Africa. Martineau thought that scheme was fantastic. American slaves were Americans. They would not want to leave. Where slavery was concerned, the last of the founders owned himself to be almost in despair. In 1836, Madison died. If the dying founders were anxious about their legacy, their heirs were no less troubled to see them go. Fathers should die before their children. It is the order of nature. But then responsibility and anxiety shift to new shoulders. In January 1838, Abraham Lincoln gave a speech to the Young Men's Lyceum of Springfield, Illinois, on the perpetuation of our political institutions. His speech was both a farewell to the Founding Fathers and a somewhat fearful look ahead. Lincoln himself was a young man as he delivered it. He would turn 29 in 2 weeks. No curious foreigner interviewed him. His remarks were printed in the Sangamo Journal, a local newspaper. Illinois was the West that Carroll had spoken of to Tocqueville, almost the frontier of American civilization. Northwestern Illinois had been the scene of an Indian war only 6 years earlier. Lincoln had served in it. No one would ever mistake Lincoln for an English aristocrat. He was the son of a subsistence farmer and carpenter, and his own property consisted mostly of debts. He had spent his early 20s bouncing from job to job: riverboatman, clerk, storekeeper, postmaster, surveyor, until he settled on politics and law, getting himself elected to the state legislature and becoming the law partner of an older officeholder. Socially, he belonged to the Democratic mass, and the life he had chosen to pursue was climbing the ladders of Democratic politics and litigation. Lincoln was an autodidact. All his schooling amounted to no more than a year in one-room schoolhouses, and he gave an autodidact speech to the Young Men's Lyceum, well planned, but stiff and a little fancy, like a brand new suit. One phrase foreshadowed the Lincoln to come. In his peroration, he said of the Founding Fathers, "What invading foemen could never do, the silent artillery of time has done. They are gone." Lincoln's artillery metaphor had the force and paradox of great poetry. Artillery is the loudest thing on a battlefield, as it is the most destructive. But the deadliest artillery of all is noiseless, quieter even than the ticking of a watch. Lincoln's metaphor also had the music of great poetry. It was a three-word variation on the letters I and T. Silent, a long I, trailed by a soft final T. Artillery, a sharp T, followed immediately by a short I.
That was Founder's Son by Richard Brookhiser. S.C. Gwynn is just out with Rebel Yell, The Violence, Passion, and Redemption of Stonewall Jackson. In April 1862, Jackson was merely another Confederate general with only a single battle credential. By mid-June, he had engineered one of the greatest military campaigns in American history. He gave the Confederate cause what it had lacked: hope. In 4 full-scale battles and 6 major skirmishes in the Shenandoah Valley, Jackson took an army that never numbered more than 17,000 men to face more than 70,000 Union troops. What was behind his genius? Jackson marched his men at a pace unknown to soldiers of the era. He made flash strikes in unexpected places and assaults of relentless fury. He struck from behind mountain ranges and out of steep passes. His use of terrain reminded observers of Hannibal and Napoleon. Cotter Smith performs the book that presents some of the 19th century's most spectacular military achievements.
Alexander Robinson Boteler stood on a platform at the train station in Charlottesville, Virginia. He was on war business, traveling under the personal orders of General Robert E. Lee. He had just arrived from Richmond, having made the 70-mile journey by rail across the blossoming, river-cut hills of the Piedmont country. Now, as he gazed about him, Boteler realized that something quite unusual was happening. The normally sleepy college town of Charlottesville, he observed, was in a fever of excitement. There was noise and commotion everywhere, though to no particular purpose. Some sort of large-scale military movement was underway, but no one, neither citizens nor soldiers, could say exactly what it was. Theories abounded. A dozen empty trains had passed mysteriously through the station earlier that day, all headed west toward the Blue Ridge Mountains and the Shenandoah Valley. None had returned. A cordon of gray-uniformed soldiers had virtually sealed the town off from the outside world, for security reasons, presumably, though what knowledge any of its citizens could possibly have imparted to the enemy was hard to say. All anyone knew was that whatever was taking place was a very large secret. Lee's orders to Boteler, in fact, had simply been to stop at Charlottesville and await orders, which seemed as cryptic as everything else that was happening that day. Boteler thought he knew what was happening. He was one of perhaps five people on Earth who could make that claim, and watching the excitement build around him in the warm spring air, he had a clear sense that he stood at one of the pivot points of the war. Great events, as he put it later, were on the gale. He was in a position to know. He was a new breed of Southern politician, spawned entirely by the exigencies of war. A former U.S. congressman from Western Virginia, he had been one of the last representatives from a Southern state to abandon the Union and had promptly been elected to the first Confederate Congress. Soon he was wielding power in a way he never had in Washington, indeed in a way that had never been done before in American politics or anticipated by the men who had designed the country's democratic systems. Genial, persistent, and charismatic, Boteler acted as a liaison between Confederate armies in the field and the capital at Richmond. He moved easily between the two worlds, an insider in both. He occupied himself with issues of military supplies and munitions, with the devastations of war on the towns in his district, even of the movements of Union armies. He'd become a sort of wartime public relations officer and courier, the link between the generals and the politicians. That was the work he was performing that day on the train platform in Charlottesville. But he was doing it now under more perilous conditions than the new Confederate nation had ever experienced. The Richmond he had left that morning was a changed city, a shaken city, where it seemed that if all hell was not yet breaking loose and full panic not quite abroad in the city's streets, both soon would be.
That was a sampling of Rebel Yell by S.C. Gwynn. The Burglary by Betty Metzger is the story of the history-changing break-in at an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania. The deed was carried out by a group of unlikely activists, ordinary, hard-working Americans who confirmed what some had long suspected, that J. Edgar Hoover had created and was operating his own shadow Bureau of Investigation. In 1971, in a country split apart by the Vietnam War, a small group of activists, inspired by Daniel Berrigan's rebellious Catholic peace movement, set out to use a more active but nonviolent method of civil disobedience. Their goal was to provide evidence the government was operating outside the laws of the land. The would-be burglars included a professor of religion and a former freedom rider, a daycare director, a physicist, a cab driver, an anti-war activist, a lock picker, and a grad student. At the heart of the heist were the contents of FBI files revealing Hoover's special counterintelligence program set up in 1956 to investigate and disrupt dissident political groups. Its agenda was to discredit, destabilize and demoralize groups, many of them legal civil rights organizations and anti-war groups that Hoover found offensive. Bronson Pinchot performs this portrait of the potential power of nonviolent resistance and the destructive power of excessive government secrecy and spying.
In late 1970, William Davidon, a mild-mannered physics professor at Haverford College, privately asked a few people this question. What do you think of burglarizing an FBI office? Even in that time of passionate resistance against the war in Vietnam that included break-ins at draft boards, his question was startling. What, besides arrests and lengthy prison sentences, could result from breaking into an FBI office? The Bureau and its legendary director, J. Edgar Hoover, had been revered by Americans and considered paragons of integrity for the nearly half century he had been director. Who would dare to think they could break into an FBI office? Surely the offices of the most powerful law enforcement agency in the country would be as secure as Fort Knox. Just talking about the possibility seemed dangerous. But Davidon, with great reluctance, had decided that burglarizing an FBI office might be the only way to confront what he considered an emergency. The likelihood that the government, through the FBI, was spying on Americans and suppressing their cherished constitutional right to dissent. If that was true, he thought, it was a crime against democracy, a crime that must be stopped. The odds were very low that such an act of resistance could possibly succeed against the law enforcement agency headed by this man who held so much power. Nicholas Katzenbach, who as Attorney General was Hoover's boss, had resigned in 1966 because of Hoover's resentment over being told by Katzenbach to manage the Bureau within the law. The director's power was unique among all national officials, said Katzenbach. He ruled the FBI with a combination of discipline and fear and was capable of acting in an excessively arbitrary way. No one dared object. The FBI was a principality with absolutely secure borders, in Hoover's view. At the same time, he said, there was no man better known or more admired by the general public than J. Edgar Hoover. Such was the power and reputation of the official whose borders and files Davidon was considering invading. He knew Hoover was very powerful, but he didn't know, nor could anyone outside the Bureau have known, how harshly he ruled it and how he protected the Bureau from having its illegal practices exposed. Katzenbach believed that Hoover, or one of the director's top aides, had even forged Katzenbach's signature in order to make it appear that the Attorney General had given permission for the FBI to plant an electronic surveillance device, a bug, in civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr.'s New York hotel room. Despite what appeared to be his signature on the memorandum, Katzenbach was certain he never approved such a procedure, which he considered the worst possible invasion of privacy. Hoover's sensitivity to criticism, Katzenbach said when he testified in December 1975 before the committee then conducting the first congressional investigation of the FBI, is almost impossible to overestimate. It went far beyond the bounds of natural resentment. The most casual statement, the most strained implication, was sufficient cause for Mr. Hoover to write a memorandum to the Attorney General complaining about the criticism, explaining why it was unjustified, and impugning the integrity of its author. In a very real sense, Katzenbach testified, there was no greater crime in Mr. Hoover's eyes than public criticism of the Bureau.
That was The Burglary by Betty Metzger. Panetta has had two of the most stellar careers of any American political servant in the past 50 years. His first 35-year career began as an Army intelligence officer and evolved into a distinguished tenure as one of Congress's most powerful and respected members. This phase culminated in the transformational role as Clinton's budget czar and White House chief of staff. Then he retired to establish the Panetta Institute, to serve on the Iraq Study Group, and to protect his beloved California coastline. But in 2009, Panetta returned to public office as the director of the CIA, taking on America's war against al-Qaeda, including the campaign that led to the killing of Osama bin Laden. Panetta next became the U.S. Secretary of Defense, inheriting two troubled wars in a time of austerity and painful choices. Worthy Fights, a memoir of leadership in war and peace, is imbued with the frank, grounded spirit of a man who's never lost touch with his roots. It is also a testament to a lost kind of political leadership, one that favors progress and duty to country over partisanship. The author narrates.
In eastern Afghanistan, Liz Hansen and her colleagues were there that day to meet a potential agent, a jihadist who said he wanted to work for the CIA and steer us to the leadership of Al-Qaeda. Instead, when he arrived at the meeting, he detonated a diabolically powerful suicide vest, killing 7 of our best and injuring a dozen more. That explosion was a signal tragedy for the CIA, one of the largest losses of life in the agency's history. The attack shook the CIA, and I had spent much of that winter and spring consoling our employees and traveling around America to share the grief of the families of those men and women. Hansen's funeral was the last of 7 such services I had attended. They included small private services and a large Catholic mass. Some were packed with dignitaries, others limited to friends and family. I met with mourners in Fredericksburg, Maryland, Virginia Beach, Clinton, Massachusetts, Akron, Ohio, and Central Illinois. And this was my 3rd trip to Arlington. After the funeral mass in Clinton, boys and girls stood in the snow outside the church, some quietly waving flags or signs that read, "Thanks for keeping us safe." In Akron, the widow of one of our fallen, Scott Roberson, was carrying his child, a girl. One eulogist imagined the day when their daughter would come to visit the CIA and touch the star etched in the marble of our memorial wall, marking her father's sacrifice, her heart full of pride for a man she never had the luck to know. 2 realizations connected all of those ceremonies. Nothing could return those young men and women to their families, and I could only offer them a promise. America would do everything in its power to bring those behind the murders to justice. They hit us, America would hit back. By 2010, nearly a decade after the events of September 11, 2001, the sustained response by America and its allies had significantly degraded Al-Qaeda. But it remained a fighting force, still under the spell of Osama bin Laden and directed by him and his close lieutenants. Now, with the burial of Elizabeth Hansen still fresh on my mind, American analysts reported that they had found one of those deputies, in fact, one of those directly responsible for the attack at Host. He was down for the night, deep in a terrorist compound. That was a significant piece of news. There was, however, a catch. He was not alone. Al-Qaeda leaders knew that American policy was to avoid civilian casualties wherever possible, and they had adapted their habits to that realization. By 2010, the organization's top terrorists would often stay close to family members or other non-combatants, theorizing that those shields would dissuade the United States from conducting operations against them. Some leaders, who had long traveled by themselves, now brought along children, exploiting our humanity while debasing their own. Now, with our target in the house, half a world away, were a wife and at least 2 children. The report suggested that others might be in the house as well. Any operation against him might kill others too. That was not a prospect I took lightly. I was raised Catholic. I was an altar boy. Since my earliest years, I've attended Mass on Sundays and holy days. I carry a rosary and believe that life is sacred. Moreover, I'm a husband and the father of 3 sons. But I also deeply believe in duty to country. I had spent the majority of my life in the service of the United States. I was in the Army. I was a Senate aide and later director of the Office for Civil Rights at the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. Aide to the mayor of New York City, congressman from the Central Coast of California, Office of Management and Budget Director, and chief of staff to President Bill Clinton.
We've just heard Worthy Fights by Leon Panetta and Jim Newton.
Between Hours presents the true account of the events of September 11, 2012, when terrorists attacked the U.S. State Department's Special Mission Compound and a nearby CIA station called the Annex in Benghazi. A team of six American security operators fought to repel the attackers and protect the American station there. Those men went beyond the call of duty, performing extraordinary acts of courage and heroism to avert tragedy on a much larger scale. This is their personal account of the infamous attack. Written by best-selling author Mitchell Zukov with the Annex security team, this riveting book takes you into the action-packed story of heroes who laid their lives on the line for one another, for their countrymen, and for their country. The author narrates.
GRS officers served as bodyguards for spies, diplomats, and other American personnel in the field. The more dangerous a posting, the more likely GRS operators were nearby in the shadows, protecting America's envoys and covert intelligence gatherers. Few, if any, postings were more dangerous than Benghazi, Libya. As a former Navy SEAL, Jack was a natural fit for the GRS. At 38 years old, self-possessed and darkly handsome, he stood 6'2" and carried 210 pounds on his muscular frame. In his usual attire of a black t-shirt and khaki shorts, Jack looked like a strapping construction worker. On the plane, though, wearing dress slacks, brown leather shoes, and a tucked-in button-down shirt, he might be mistaken for an American businessman seeking export-import opportunities 10 months after the death of deposed dictator Muammar al-Gaddafi. At least that was Jack's hope as the jet's wheels touched down. Jack's arrival marked his first visit to Libya and the start of his sixth trip as a GRS operator. His previous trips had taken him to the Middle East and elsewhere. For official purposes in Benghazi, Jack would simply say that he'd be working as a security staffer for diplomats from the U.S. State Department. Men who protect spies don't advertise that fact. Before leaving the plane, Jack slipped off his gold wedding band and tucked it into a small box for safekeeping. He'd picked up the habit years earlier, after deciding that he didn't want his enemies to know that he had a family, a wife and two young sons waiting for him back home in the Pacific Northwest. Jack stepped onto the tarmac and felt the bone-dry afternoon heat of the Libyan summer. His aviator sunglasses were modest protection from the harsh white glare of the North African sun. Entering the rundown terminal building, Jack pushed through the doors to a room with a luggage carousel and more than 100 people packed inside a space that would have felt crowded with half as many. His fellow luggage seekers, most of them men, shouted in Arabic and gestured wildly as they fought to claim bags. The air was thick with flies and the nauseating stench of baked-on body odor. Jack took short breaths through his mouth in a futile effort to keep both at bay. He'd been on guard from the moment he left the plane, a reflex reaction whenever Jack arrived in a hostile territory. Hyper-aware, his jaw set, his every movement grew deliberate, measured to convey in body language that he wasn't looking for trouble, but he wouldn't flinch from it either. Jack felt the stares of strangers upon him and knew that at least some were armed. He also knew that everyone watching him had reached the same instant conclusion: American. He suspected that at least some wished him dead. As he waited for his bags, Jack caught sight of a burly, bearded man standing with his back against a wall at the periphery of the scrum. The man's eyes scanned the crowd while his body remained as still as a lizard on a tree limb. He wore khaki cargo pants and a navy blue button-down shirt, untucked, Jack knew, to conceal a gun in the waistband. Their eyes met for an instant. Jack returned his gaze to the luggage carousel, and the bearded man remained expressionless, glued to the wall. When Jack grabbed his bags, the man pushed away from the wall and turned toward the exit door leading to customs. Jack followed a short distance behind. By the time Jack stepped outside the terminal building, he and the bearded man had closed the distance between them and fallen into step with each other. Still, they didn't speak as the man led Jack toward a white Toyota pickup truck caked in dust. Jack tossed his bags in the back and slid into the passenger seat. The bearded man got behind the wheel. In a single practiced motion, the man reached down and grabbed a pistol. "It's loaded," the man said. He held it out, butt end first. Jack relaxed as he took the gun. He reached out his right hand and returned a powerful handshake offered by his fellow former SEAL and GRS colleague Tyrone Woods, whose radio call sign was Roan. "How's it going, brother?" Roan said, a bright smile emerging from his thick salt-and-pepper beard. As Roan started the truck, they caught up on each other's lives and families and set aside those thoughts like wedding rings slipped into boxes. Roan drove toward the airport exit, bound for an upscale neighborhood called Western Fuahat. Their destination was a CIA-rented property known as the Annex, which was the agency's secret headquarters in Benghazi. Less than a mile from the Annex was the United States' public presence in the city, a walled estate known as the U.S. Special Mission Compound, which served as a base for State Department diplomats.
We've just heard 13 Hours by Mitchell Zukov. David Axelrod is the savvy strategist who masterminded Obama's historic election campaigns. In Believer, My 40 Years in Politics, Axelrod opens up about his years as a young journalist, political consultant, and ultimately senior advisor to the president. As a young newspaperman in the Chicago of 1970s and 1980s, Axelrod reported on the dissolution of the last of the big city political machines, along with the emergence of a black independent movement that made Obama's ascent possible. Axelrod switched careers to become a political strategist, working for Obama and Hillary Clinton, and morally conflicted characters like John Edwards. For better and worse, Axelrod helped to redefine the techniques by which modern political campaigns are run. The Heart of Believer is devoted to Axelrod's 20-year friendship with Obama. As a senior advisor to the president, Axelrod worked at Obama's side as he battled an economic disaster, navigated America through two wars, and fought to reform healthcare, the financial sector, and our gridlocked political institutions. The author narrates.
Whether I am the candidate for the presidency or president or stay in the Senate, I regard our obligation not to please you, but to serve you. And in my judgment, in 1960, a candidate for the presidency should be willing to give the truth to the people. And the truth is that what we are now doing is not good enough. I was too young to understand the full meaning of his speech or the magnitude of the moment. I recovered his words only years later from one of those online archives no one back then could have imagined. I might not have understood exactly why the crowd cheered when it did, or that Kennedy was desperately seeking votes, locked in what would be one of the closest presidential contests ever. Yet to this 5-year-old, the scene was pure magic, electric, and important. Though I couldn't grasp the nuances, I somehow absorbed the larger message. We are the masters of our future, and politics is the means by which we shape it. From that moment on, I was hooked. I wanted to be part of the action. 52 years later, on November 5th, 2012, I stood at the foot of the stage at another huge outdoor rally on the eve of another presidential election. It was 10 p.m. in Des Moines. A crowd of 20,000 stretched from the podium on Locust Street, 4 blocks east, toward the glistening gold dome of the Iowa State Capitol. They waited for hours on that chilly November night to watch President Barack Obama deliver the final speech at the final campaign stop of his political career, and mine. For Team Obama, it was a homecoming. 4 years earlier, Iowans had breathed life into his audacious candidacy for president. Obama had virtually taken up residence there, spending 89 days in the state during the run-up to Iowa's critical first-in-the-nation presidential caucuses as he made his case for change. Along the way, he developed strong bonds with the folks he met in countless living rooms, diners, and union halls across the state. While the pundits and political insiders in Washington were smugly writing him off as a political shooting star, Obama placed his bet on Iowa and the army of idealistic young people who descended upon the state, hell-bent on changing the course of history. And without Iowa's embrace, his candidacy almost certainly would have died a quick, snowy death. Iowa was the beginning of everything. Now, steeled by 1,000 battles, Obama had returned there to plead his case, seeking the chance to finish what he had started. He had taken bold and controversial steps to revive a wounded economy. But the work of redeeming an embattled middle class was far from done. He had ended our war in Iraq, and having brought Osama bin Laden and many of al-Qaeda's leaders to justice, was on the path to ending another war in Afghanistan. Yet it would take a continued commitment to bring those troops home, and the world would only become more complex and challenging. After a lengthy and bruising fight to pass historic health care reform, it would take his next term to implement and undergird it against continuing opposition efforts at subversion and repeal. He felt an urgency to deal with the great unresolved problems of climate change and immigration reform, and maybe, just maybe, a second resounding victory would pave the way for more comity and cooperation in Washington, which was the great unfulfilled promise of his presidency. A year earlier, following a devastating standoff with Congress over the nation's debt limit, Obama's standing with the public had hit a new low. Some polls showed his approval rating sinking perilously below 40%. Trial heats with Mitt Romney, the likely Republican nominee, showed the president running well below the majority he would need to win. Nate Silver, the whiz kid political handicapper, who later would win plaudits for accurately calling the outcome of the election, had written a provocative and, for our team, thoroughly depressing magazine piece for the New York Times with a pointed headline, "Is Obama Toast?" And while Obama remained publicly defiant back then, he was privately resigned to the prospect of defeat. "I'm realistic about this. We have an uphill fight," he said during one of our conversations in the dark days of 2011. "Michelle and I have talked about it, about where we would live if we lose. The girls are settled here now, so we really need to think about that."
We've just heard Believer by David Axelrod. Readers, the plethora of current political books offer up some compelling reads. And with the presidential election just ahead, we can expect a landslide of titles. To see which are worth your vote, keep checking my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining me today, and please elect to join me in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.